Back with you on The Takeaway, I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and it's good to have you with us. Let's head on out now to the Pacific Northwest, to Seattle, Washington. Officially, the city's municipal elections are nonpartisan, but by any measure, Seattle is a Democratic stronghold. And by many measures, it's a bright, blue, progressive version of the Democratic Party. In 2017, Mayor Jenny Durkan was elected as Seattle's first woman mayor in nearly a century, and its second openly LGBTQ mayor. She came to office with an aggressively progressive agenda centered on equitable access to education. But just as Durkan began to prepare for re-election, she faced a series of unforeseen crises. She was one of the first big city mayors to manage a significant outbreak of COVID-19. And even though she is a former prosecutor with strong law enforcement bona fides, Durkan was roundly criticized for the way she managed the protests for racial equality after Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd. Late last year, Durkan decided not to seek re-election, and in November of this year, former City Council President Bruce Harrell defeated Lorena Gonzalez in a race that seems to signal that Seattle residents hope to temper the city's progressivism. As she enters her final weeks in office, I sat down with Mayor Durkan to understand the ways she thinks about Seattle and what she hopes is next for the Queen City.
Seattle, like cities across America and across the globe, are tired and depleted in many ways. These have been such extraordinarily difficult 2 years with the global pandemic, with the impacts on our health and our economy, with the civil rights reckoning and all of us having to dig deep on what does the future and equitable future really look like. And so I think that there's, you know, people have been tapped out in many ways, but I couldn't be more proud of what Seattle's been able to do. You know, we were the first in the global pandemic with very little help from the federal government, sometimes working against the then President Trump. And at the same time, every time we asked folks to step up and do the hard thing, to follow the science, they did it to deep sacrifice for themselves and their families. It doesn't erase the enormous guilt and loss and that people have had, but we were able to follow the science and come through. And while we did it, we really had to examine what we were doing on in terms of equity and move forward on those programs too. You have to operate at multiple levels. And I think the city of Seattle is a city that really is committed to the future and a just and equitable future. And we'll do the hard things to get there.
You know, seeing the first cases in the country right there in Seattle, and then, of course, that initial explosion of COVID, particularly among the elderly, and then to now be able to say what a low rate, and of course, even one person is too many, but to have such a dramatic set of accomplishments in a meaningful, impactful public health realm. I got to say, Mayor, there was a time in American politics where simply being able to say that alone would have basically ensured you a second term as mayor, if that's what you wanted. But this is not that time in politics, and you did make a decision not to run for re-election. Can you talk about that decision?
Yeah, and I think that you're right about this not being that time in American politics. Last December, you know, I was looking at where we were as a city. We had stood up a testing program that was kind of first in the nation, but to this day we've done, you know, 1.2 million in free tests, 60% of residents, but we didn't have the vaccine yet. We still had so much to do in the area of policing and standing up alternatives to policing to recover from the pandemic and to do all the other things that a city needs to do. And it was really clear to me that I could not both run for the office and do the work that we needed to do to get our city positioned to really recover and build that just and equitable future. Everything would have been viewed through that political prism. And as you know, today in American politics, things can become hyper-politicized and hyper-polarized really quickly. And so I thought the number one thing I could do for my city was to really focus on getting us to the best place possible.
I think that's a rather stunning statement about our politics, to say I couldn't both run for the office and do the work of the office at the same time. Does that indicate there's something broken about how we run for office in this country?
I think there's something broken about how we conduct elected office in this country. And if you look at the national level, I would say it is the most broken, because you've now become so hyper-politicized that you literally lock up by party rather than look at principle. and have people to be able to roll up their sleeves and work across party lines to work on a common goal or common agenda for the country. But you're starting to see that at the local level too, and everything is so much more proximate. When you're the mayor of a city, people give you their views when you're, you know, shopping at the grocery store or, you know, you name it, picking up your kids at school, whatever happens, people have an opinion and it happens right there. And you see it. You walk through your town, you talk to people and you see everything. But we've seen now this politicizations at school boards and health officers where it's not enough that you disagree with people and then look to find a way to resolve those disagreements. People have to become the enemy or vilified in a way that dehumanizes them. I think that's one of the most dangerous things that we're facing as a country. How do we get out of that hyper polarization and really focus on our common humanity and common future?
One of the clearest flashpoints for disagreement has clearly been the question of race and of policing. And it is happening in American cities and perhaps no more centrally than in Seattle in the summer of 2020. As you look at back now, just I guess a year and a half later, start by talking a little bit about the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. In your understanding, what was sort of the value, the purpose of that space?
So I think as history is written, looking back at that time, it will be a encapsulated view of what was happening in America. And like you said, the issue of policing and race being this point of conflict, you can't separate the two if you look at the history of America. And the origins of the protest were the murder of George Floyd, but so much more was being expressed there. It was generational deprivation of being, common humanity, access to opportunity, the American dream. And people saying what really makes community safety is not the presence of police alone. What makes a community safe is access to, good health care, good prenatal care, preschools, educational opportunity, affordable housing, the things that make a healthy community also reduce the need to call police. And we see that where there are healthy communities and that disparity between what has happened to our communities of color and particularly Black Americans, you look across all of those markers of what indicates opportunity and health. And the fall off is undeniable. So I think the first thing we have to recognize is the protests were a confluence of events and that people were not just protesting the murder of George Floyd, which they were, but that itself exemplified so many other generational traumas and injuries, and that you really had to address those protests in that way. So you had to deal, I think it was the most dynamic and sometimes volatile situation that our city's seen, and having to address both the protests themselves, but and how do you build policing that is better and more just? Because I personally think it's a false choice to say we need alternatives to police or police. I think we have to have both, but you've got to listen to community and address those needs. So you had to address the protests themselves, you had to address the First Amendment work, the public safety, but at the same time, if you didn't have a plan to make those long-term community investments, you weren't addressing really the reasons people were in the street.
I'm wondering if it's at all surprising to you, just given the demographics of Seattle. I mean, it is certainly a diverse city, but the African-American population there being about 7%, which is well below kind of national 12% and well below in so many other places where we think of like the racial divide as a core question, where you might have 15 or 20% African-Americans, sometimes even particularly in cities, a majority African-American cities. But this is a place, Seattle, again, with its diversity, but it is diversity that's primarily Asian American. I'm wondering if it was at all surprising that it was Seattle that became, at least, I think for many members of the right, including for President Trump, who called the city an anarchist city, that it was Seattle that somehow stood in this fraught moment.
In many ways, it's not surprising. And I think one reason President Trump singled out Seattle is because we are a threat to his worldview. because we can have diversity. And even though African Americans make up only 7%, if you're committed to equity and justice, that is almost irrelevant. And so we are a city that has led the nation in many times on issues, whether it's the $15 minimum wage, whether it's protections for rideshare drivers, because we are able as a city to find our way through these difficult issues and come out with some solutions. Never perfect solutions, because it's humans, right? But so I think that for President Trump, one, having a woman mayor, you know, he singled out a number of women mayor across the country, whether it was Keisha Bottoms in Atlanta or Lori Lightfoot in Chicago, but also because if Seattle gets it right, it shows his worldview is wrong. Also, we've just always been a city that has been, you know, we got protests in our blood. And it's been that way my whole life here, whether it was against the war or for civil rights. You know, our first women's march here had over 250,000 people when Trump was inaugurated. So people are very engaged, very publicly conscious. And when they think that something's unjust, they're going to tell you about it.
We've talked about kind of the racial divide, but there are, of course, other critical political intersections of identity, some of which you embody as a woman mayor, as a queer mayor, and some of the disagreement as you talked about. I mean, on the one hand, democracy is working when you can walk up to your mayor in the grocery store and tell your mayor how you feel. There's, you know, that feels like democracy at work. But if you tell your mayor how you feel with slurs that include homophobic slurs or gendered violence slurs, that's something quite different. So I'm wondering how you experienced, you know, obviously as a human, but also as a leader, and how you in a moment like that address it.
You know, I think that that's a really good question. And I think it goes back to what I was saying before. For me, I think one of the big dangers is not just this hyper-polarization, but the normalization of it. And so I, as a mayor, you know, I had a significant number of death threats against myself and my family to the point where we had to have 24-hour police protection at our home. At the same time, we had people coming to our home repeatedly and doing spray-painted hate speech that took significant time to remove, time after time. There was a period of time where we had our son move out of our house because we determined it wasn't safe for him to be there. No elected official should have to shoulder that as well. And we shouldn't normalize that. We shouldn't say anyone asked for it because they ran for office. And I think that I would say that really one thing journalism needs to do is itself also report that and draw the bright line. Because at first it's the mayors and people who, you know, were for or against me could justify, oh, that's because of X, or that's what you get for when you run for office. But then we saw it go to the school board members who decided that kids needed to get vaccinated, or public health officials who believed in masks. And that has such a corrosive impact on our democracy. I mean, you really want good people to stand up and be engaged in their community. But if the price is, you know, the safety of their family, they won't make that choice.
Yeah. Now, here's the best part of not running for re-election, Mayor. You can now give some advice. So I'm gonna ask you just in a few areas as you're looking across the country at other big city mayors, or just in general, as for all of us as citizens and residents, how we might approach some big questions. So let's start with housing and housing equity and fairness, and how to create cities that are both thriving economically, but where somebody can also afford to live on a reasonable person's salary.
Yep. And in big cities, it's been one of the greatest challenges I had coming into Seattle. We had explosive growth, but the growth came from people who were earning significant salaries. So as mayor, we've done $2.5 billion in affordable housing, 7,600 new units, and it's still not enough. So we need to change our approach, for example, zoning laws to allow more middle income type housing in every part of the city. We need to make sure that, as I did when we decided to commit to the affordable housing, I put an executive order that was an anti-gentrification displacement order, so the people from that community or who were pushed out of the community could have first shot at that affordable housing. You know, we have seen enormous change. When I grew up in Seattle, the area that's called the Central District was about 70% Black. Today, it's less than 14%. That is all the pressures, economic pressures of gentrification. If you want to have a city that really is diverse and has everything that makes a great city, you've got to make a commitment that there can be a place, a home for people. So I think every mayor has to realize they have to focus on that, but we have to put more pressure on the federal government. There has not been a nationwide commitment to affordable housing at the scale we need it for generations. And I've talked to Secretary Fudge. She's going to be a great ally on that front. And President Biden has so many challenges. But America has grown quickly, and that housing is so critical to every other thing in a person's life. And so I think housing, mayors, do what you can, but force your governors and pressure the federal administration to do what they can too. And always remember, I mean, I think the most important thing that mayors know is we see the human impacts. You know, when they talk about the budget in Washington, D.C., it's like, well, will you take $1 trillion or you take a half a trillion? We don't think in terms of trillions. We think in terms of the humans that we see. You know, the kids who can't get to school or the families lined up at the food bank. We see that. And that's one thing I think that every elected official should never lose sight of. These aren't just dollars on a page. They really are what impacts people's lives.
Let's talk about transportation next, another key aspect of life in American cities. Advice on how to think about equitable access to transportation.
So I think there's a couple things. Number one, we need more public transportation. And we are a transit-friendly, light rail-friendly city, but we saw during the pandemic, like everyone else, people quit using it because they were fearful of the pandemic. So we've got to build more of it. And the other thing that I did coming in is we saw that our high school students didn't have access to transportation the same way they should. And so that impacted their ability to get jobs, to take advantage of other opportunities. So I came in and did two things. One, we put in a program for 2 years free college for every Seattle Public High School student. And we gave every Seattle Public High School student a free transit pass that can be used on our transit, on our light rail. And it opened up so many opportunities, even I have never thought of as a mayor for those students. So I think you have to make as much of the transportation free for as many people. We also were able to give these passes to a lot of people living in low-income housing, not everyone, but making sure that as you build out this expensive infrastructure in a city, if it's not accessible to people, it becomes another way that hardens inequity instead of opening opportunity.
And then I think the last one I'll ask you about here is education and trying to think about the ways that education is part of economic development and equity.
Absolutely. I think it's one of the critical linchpins, and it starts with good pre-K. So I was also able to expand our free pre-K to double the size it was. And I have to tell you, I go to these preschool classes. I could tell when I had a hard day or hard schedule because my staff would have this on my calendar would be visit to a preschool. And the joy, there's only one thing that was better than the joy on the kids' faces. And that was the joy on the parents' faces, because suddenly they had a place for their children that was safe, that was going to give them opportunity, and that then they could do other things in their life, work, whatever they were doing. And then the 2 years free college, preparing a gateway for these students to grab them when they're younger in high school, start talking about what they wanted to do, give them the right support and counseling, have that same kind of support when they landed in the colleges, and then pairing that with the internships at the great companies we have here. And we just were able to change state law to get a 4-year degree in our community colleges for computer sciences, which starting salaries are like $140,000. So now being able to provide really good, solid education, but also pair that with opportunity. And we've worked with our, you know, our Port of Seattle, because not every kid wants to be a computer science person, right? So we're working with our labor unions for apprenticeship programs and our fire department to see how we get people into firefighting, but to really be thinking about what are those pathways so that, you know, we have one of the highest minimum wages in the country. It's not enough for a family to live on. And so we have to be providing these pathways to actual employment and opportunities that can support a family and support their children.
So you've given some advice to other mayors, maybe even to your own mayor-elect Bruce Harrell, who's coming in. But I'm interested to know what's next for you.
You know, I am not sure yet. I'm going to take some time off. I'm a person who runs through the tape, so we've got some time left and we are trying to get it done. And then it's been extraordinarily challenging for my family as well. And I think we just want to take some time, reassess, decompress, and then look for the next way that, you know, we can contribute.
Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me. You take care.